Sila Kawiti is the Chief Executive Officer and Chair of the Board of Directors, and Dr. Randy Schreckengost is the Chief Scientific Officer for Targapeutics, a company which has a mission to come up with new therapies which is so badly needed to try and solve the mystery of diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, which is better known as DIPG, and diffuse midline glioma, or DMG, which are the two most problematic pediatric brain cancers of which there are no cures for. Both Syl and Randy are here today to talk about this mission, and it is my honor to introduce them to my audience and welcome them to my podcast. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me, and it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Looking forward to our time together.
Now, I'm going to ask Syl the first question, and it's going to be about your background. You graduated from Villanova in 1985, and after working for Deloitte & Touche in the corporate finance field, you became an entrepreneur by working on startup companies which were focused on drug development in their early stages. What led you to this field, and what led you to trying to help the most difficult of pediatric brain cancer diseases, as you're doing with your company called Targapeutics?
Well, Mark, again, thanks so much for having us on your podcast this morning. Randy and I love telling our story, and with your platform, really look forward to telling it to as many people as we can. I came to Targapeutics, honestly, when my mom died from an adult brain tumor called glioblastoma multiforme, and that was in 2001. And I was very involved in her care, and at the time, struck by how few options she had in terms of any therapy that would even give her and our family any hope. And so I got involved with Targapeutics after learning about the technology and its promise. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, and Randy can expand on that. We fast forward to the most difficult to treat cancers, as you articulated, DIPG and DMG. That really came about as a result of work and collaborations that we've had at both Penn State Health and at the Mayo Clinic, understanding the potential benefit of our drug and our target. And again, I think Randy might be able to expand on that a little bit more. You gave me the title of an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs don't really mean much in this business. A venture capitalist would tell you, you really need four things. You need assets, IP, management, and money. We know and we're confident that we have four of those things. The first three, IP, assets, and management. Money is really what we lack. So in terms of the management part of that, you can't do any of this without really good science, really good people, really good collaborations, and most importantly, somebody that can really bring all that together. And that's really where Randy comes in. And I'll let you introduce Randy, and Randy give a little bit of his background. But when you think about Targapeutics, Randy's really the one that brings it all together and drives the process moving forward.
Well, Randy, it's again very nice to have you here. I know you're a physician, but you were kind enough to say I can call you Randy. Now, you are the Chief Scientific Officer for Targapeutics after 20 years in cancer research and more than a decade spent on drug discovery after your education, which you received your PhD in microbiology from the University of Virginia and your postdoctorate at Thomas Jefferson University. You've spent many years involved in prostate cancer clinical trials. What led you to joining Syl Targapeutics Targapeutics?
Yeah, thanks, Mark, for the introduction. Just to clarify, I'm a PhD, not a physician, not a clinical physician. And That's only important if my wife listens to this, because she is a physician and we do not have the same title. So happy to have you call me Randy, but thank you for that introduction. I've spent my entire career in cancer biology and in cancer research and understanding what drives cancers and what makes them not respond to therapies. And as you mentioned, I spent time since my postdoc training kind of in the prostate cancer world. I was in a dynamic lab at Thomas Jefferson, kind of studying that disease, and was able to take some of my training and knowledge into a small biotech company in central Pennsylvania, which is how I met Syl initially, and was excited to have that work be instrumental in starting some clinical trials for prostate cancer, which have continued to proceed. So, I mean, my trip to Target Therapeutics really started because of that initial time in central Pennsylvania. Central PA, we're based in Hershey, Pennsylvania, not just for this chocolate, but does have a little bit of biotech here, but it's not a huge community. So I was able to know Syl through these other companies. And right around the fall of 2019, I was just asked to provide some assistance on some animal protocols and some studies to get started in their lab, and kind of became clear that coming on in a full-time capacity would be beneficial for both of us, for Therapeutics and for myself.
Now, your company mission in general is to come up with new therapies that are so desperately needed in the pediatric brain cancer world, especially with the diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, DIPG, and diffuse midline glioma, which is DMG, in which there are currently no cures for, which I mentioned earlier. You use a genetically engineered protein called GB13 as your engine for this therapy. Please talk about this protein and how long did it take for you to perfect it to the point where you became confident in its success possibilities for these brain cancers? And whoever wants to take this question is fine.
Yeah, I'll get started in some of the biology of it, and Syl can talk about maybe the history of it a little bit more, because Therapeutics is not necessarily a young company, but our activity right now has been really instrumental in the last handful of years. But GB13 is exciting because it really has kind of two pieces of it that make it special. The first part is taking this engineered component that you mentioned. It uses a normal protein that's found in the body, but we have mutated it to allow it to be really specific in what it binds to. So there's a target that's found on brain cancer cells. It's a certain receptor called the IL-13 receptor alpha 2. And that's important because that protein is only expressed on cancer cells. It's not found on normal cells. So we've made our engineered protein to only bind to those cells that express that receptor. So it's not going to bind to normal cells of the body. It's only going to hit the cancer cells, which is really important when we're trying to cure a cancer and treat kids. We don't want to have side effects that are going to have unintended consequences. And then attached to that protein is another protein that's doing the business end of it. So we're using a Pseudomonas exotoxin. So this toxin is very potent. We need very little of that potent toxin to get into the cell to then kill it. So we can target GB13 specifically to the cancer cells, and then we can kill it with very little required protein. So I don't know if you want to talk about how long we've been around or how much that comes into play, but most recently we've been involved in this collaboration that Syl mentioned with Mayo Clinic, who was really instrumental in testing GB13 in these models of DIPG and DMG. And that's really where we said, wow, we have something special here. The people that saw the data said, wow, that's pretty special. We don't usually see responses in these models that are being tested. And that really has kind of driven our focus to be in the pediatric space right now.
And did you want to say anything further about that, Syl, or should I just go on to the next part of it?
I would keep going on, Mark. I think some of the other things will kind of flesh itself out.
Okay. Now, is it fair to say that the distinguishing feature of this protein is that a difficulty in the past is that when targeted therapies have been able to attack tumor cells, they have not been able to avoid attacking healthy cells, which Randy, you had mentioned, and that B13 attacks tumors and is able to avoid healthy cells. Now, I would just add to that question, is that in 100% of these cases?
So that's a really good question. And I think, as I did mention, GB13 does bind to a receptor that's only found in tumor cells. So it's not ever found in normal cells in the brain. We have really strong data, and I'm not going to make this data heavy, but has demonstrated that there is a strong preference to bind to cells that have that receptor. And you need a ton of overdosing and of levels that we're never going to achieve before it interacts with anything else in those tumor cells. So when we think about a clinical setting, it's going to be binding to the cells that are the tumor cells. The problem with treating DIPG and DMG is that there really isn't anything out there that does anything, right? As you mentioned, it's incurable. And the treatments that are currently being used as standard of care are not targeted therapies. So we're talking about radiation as standard of care. That is, there is focusing of that radiation, but that is nonspecific. So you're going to have some bystander toxicity there. And that radiation is not increasing survival. That is really more of a palliative function. There is some chemotherapy that can be used. Again, that's not specific. We really are proud that we have a therapy that is targeted and is going to be killing the tumor. So we can do that without having negative side effects.
I've read many times that one of the most important, or maybe the most important, problem with these brain cancers has been there's no way to effectively get past the brain blood barrier, and GB13 is GB13 designed to get past this barrier and be able to attack the tumors that way, or is this just a different issue?
Yeah, it's a huge issue for any CNS tumor. So we're talking adult glioblastoma, we're talking pediatric DIPG, DMG. It is an issue. The blood-brain barrier does its job. It's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to keep things that aren't normal found in the body out of the CNS. So GB13 is a large molecule. It's a large protein. It is never going to get through the blood-brain barrier by itself. There are very few drugs that do that well. You have this trade-off. If your drug does get through the blood-brain barrier naturally, you often need to administer it in such a high concentration that you have high levels in the circulation just to get that little bit that's needed into the brain normally. So that's one scenario that is a problem for drug development in this field. So GB13, we would never be able to give it at a dose that would get it across the blood-brain barrier because it's such a large protein. Really rely on an administration route called convection enhanced delivery. Convection enhanced delivery, we'll call it CED, is a catheter-based infusion method. So this requires a neurosurgical procedure that inserts a catheter directly into the tumor. This is the same for, we can do this for GBM, we can do it for DIPG, but the catheter is using imaging software, is implanted directly into the tumor. We can then infuse GB13 directly into the tumor and allow it to kind of soak up like a sponge would soak up something and allow the tumor to be filled with our drug. So that has a lot of benefit because it allows us to give a really local concentration of GB13 without having it administered anywhere else. Again, we talked about the safety. Nothing's 100% safe, but we can give it directly where it needs to be. We've just increased its safety. We've eliminated the exposure to any other part of the body.
Now, as a layman, and perhaps other people listening to this podcast are also laymen in the medical sense, what differentiates GB13? Is there something that you have created to design this protein which other drugs do not have? Is that the reason that you have been able to separate getting the connections to the right cells, meaning the sick cells versus the cells that are okay?
So, Randy, let me handle this since I'm more of the layman.
Yep.
I think Mark, Randy really just covered it, and let me at a higher level, maybe just discuss a couple things. Number one, convection enhanced delivery (CED) is not new. It's not novel. There have been modifications made over the years to how it is placed, to the types of catheters that are used, et cetera. So this is a delivery mechanism that's in place at a number of facilities around the world. Our drug specifically with convection enhanced delivery is designed, again, together to be placed directly into the tumor site. And our drug is designed to be diffused around that tumor site. From there, our targeting agent, the targeting piece of our drug that Randy mentioned, is designed to only seek out, look for, and impact those cancer cells. The business end, as Randy would say, of our compound, the Pseudomonas exotoxin, is once this cancer cell is sought out and attacked, the business end eradicates that tumor cell. I think another thing might be important for us to talk about, we're going to talk a little bit about where we fit in the paradigm of care. And we talk about the paradigm of care as a way of introducing what we believe might be the ultimate answer for these patients and their families, and that is many different therapies going to work on this cancer. And so, again, we're going to talk about it a little bit later on, I believe, about the work that we've done in collaboration with Mayo, how radiation impacts GB13, how GB13 impacts radiation. But again, at a high level, it's both the convection-enhanced delivery, which is the delivery mechanism, and our targeting of just cancer cells specifically and safely, and then how we deliver the toxin to eradicate the cancer cell.
Well, thank you for that. Very good explanation. Now, I'd like to ask Randy about his work at trying to find the right medicines for prostate cancer, which you have had quite a bit of experience at. And how much more difficult has it been to come up with a drug such as GB13, in that there has been so much success in alleviating prostate cancer and no success in alleviating DIPG and DMG?
Yeah, Mark, I think this could be its own podcast. So I'll try to just kind of just mention, because really this could be, I mean, this is a kind of a big question. It's an important question to be thinking about this and how we can have success in one area and not the other. There are a couple of differences just biologically between prostate cancer and these gliomas we're talking about. Prostate cancer does typically, I'm going to just talk very generally here. There are nuances of all these topics, but prostate cancer is not going to be growing as aggressively as DIPG. So that is a big thing right there. The time window of diagnosis versus kind of getting serious is different between prostate cancer and DIPG. I think even just understanding what the main driver of these diseases is different. So prostate cancer has been well established that the androgen receptor is the key molecule that's kind of the gatekeeper for cancer progression in prostate cancer. So that's why bicalutamide, which is also called Casodex, was the gold standard of treatment for a long time. And the new therapies that have been really effective have been variations of that original therapy. We have to stop the androgen receptor signaling to stop prostate cancer. And that's kind of, once you get that down, now you've created a chronic disease. So now if something else comes up, then you can treat that thing. So there are lots of therapies out there because we've been able to slow down the growth. With brain cancer, there really isn't one gatekeeper molecule to target right now that we are aware of. There's been a lot of advances in the last handful of years of understanding the biology of these diseases. That's why we have DIPG and DMG now. We understand molecularly that there are certain things that make it a DMG, this 27 mutation. That's a big deal. And we just know about that because of the technology that's been out there. That technology had already been applied to prostate cancer a long time ago. So we had this sequencing data. We've had this proteomic data. And you think about where that disease is located, it's much easier to take out a prostate surgically than it is to take out a glioma surgically. So the access to tissue for the researchers was more progressed in prostate cancer than it has been in DIPG. It's become just recently more acceptable to take biopsies of DIPG patients, and it's been proven to be safe. And that step has been huge for researchers to get tissue, to be able to test it, to be able to understand the molecular background of these cancers. That's how we understand what is driving the cancer. And that's probably, I'm happy to, if you have any other follow-up questions, I'm happy to talk about that. But I think those are some of the main differences in studying the prostate cancer field for drug development versus the glioma field.
I'm going to add a couple of questions that weren't in the original email that I sent you. And the first one, I don't know if it's a simplistic question. I'm sure it is. But is there one thing that you can say that causes DIPG in the brain? Or is it just, I don't know if luck of the draw is the right way to put it. Thankfully, there are, one diagnosis is too many, but the 400 is certainly something, thankfully, that hasn't, overwhelmed everybody. And I just didn't know with that type of diagnosis, that amount, is there something that triggers it in these kids?
Yeah, I don't think we can say that there's one thing that we can point to say this is what's causing this. I think having this disease start at such a young age, it's really hard to know. I think that's also the difference between prostate cancer, that you have so much more of an ability to track of the beginning. You have many more patients, so it's able to see these trends show up more frequently. With 400 patients, it is harder to understand what's happening. There really hasn't been a clear, like, this is the thing that's driving it. Yeah, it's a good question, though.
And Mark, let me add something real quick. You had asked earlier about, a question. Randy said that just recently they've been able to do biopsies of DMG, DIPG. Not only, as Randy pointed out, is access an issue, but with that new capability and ability, you have, and you've been to some of these meetings, you have an ability of groups to really be able to collect these cells and to be able to analyze these cells and then to be able to understand these cells in a way that years ago they weren't really able to do. As Randy said, we have a new mutation, the HVK27M mutation, and that wasn't understood a number of years ago. I bring that up as a way of saying that hopefully that trend continues. Hopefully, patients and their families commit to providing those cells to those groups that analyze them so that we maybe can try to understand, genetically what's going on. And again, it's as you pointed out, it's a numbers thing. You know, 1 in 3 men will have prostate cancer. That's a big number. As you pointed out, 400 kids a year are getting DMG, DIPG. It's not a big number.
Can it be overemphasized about the importance of when DIPG patient passes away, how critical can it be down the road to have their brain or the cells donated for research? And along with that, why are there some hospitals, more than a few, I believe, which don't permit something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to that second point at all. So, I mean, I'm not sure if SIL does or not, but I think that SIL is kind of referring to having access to this tissue is really important. And we've benefited from that. We've had published data with our collaborations that has used these patient-derived cells and have been instrumental in understanding the effectiveness of our drug. We mentioned this target. It's expressed in the majority of DIPG patients, but not 100% of DIPG patients. So it's been really important for us to be able to understand and start to test, like, why does somebody have that but not somebody else? How do we make sure that we're treating the right patients? How are we making sure that we're giving our drug to only the patients that are going to benefit from that? That's important for us. And I mean, I think the research community as a whole is grateful. And you see this at the meetings that we go to when patient advocates are there. These are the parents of kids. And if they're in that position, it's probably because their child has passed away. And that's, I mean, everybody in the community recognizes that and appreciates it and are super grateful for that commitment to the research. Because without it, we wouldn't even be where we are today. It's cannot be overemphasized, I would say. That's a great point, Mark.
Now, you use the word collaboration, and it's been a major part of Targapeutics as you work with other researchers on this issue. How has this collaboration helped? And are these researchers on board with GB13?
Let me take that at a high level, Mark. So we have been very fortunate to have been able to collaborate with some of the best researchers and institutions around the world interested in DMG-DIPG. We mentioned a couple of them, Penn State, which is somewhat in our backyard. As Randy mentioned, we're based in Hershey, Pennsylvania. We've mentioned Mayo Clinic and the critical work that we've been doing with clinicians at them and researchers at the Mayo Clinic. We've also been working with UAB, Children's Hospital, consortiums of Children's Hospital. We'll mention that further when we get to the discussion around our proposed clinical study. But just let's stipulate that these collaborations are critical. And again, you have 400 kids a year and their families being impacted by this disease. This is all hands on deck. And so you need this collaboration. And so I'll pick on one thing. And again, I can, as Randy said, spend a whole nother podcast on our relationship with UAB and with Children's, but I'll pick on the relationship that we have with Mayo. So last year at a Society of Neuro-Oncology meeting, a pediatric specific neuro-oncology meeting, our collaborators at Mayo discussed the potential role that GB13 plays in the paradigm of care with radiation. Again, as Randy discussed, and we all know, radiation can be focalized, so it can be delivered, but it's not really made a difference in terms of the patient's lives so far. One of the things that we started to disclose was potentially using GB13 to help make the radiation better. And so we really think of it doing two things. Not only reducing the tumor burden that we've discussed, but making the radiation better. So it's a real 1 + 1 = 9 kind of thing. There are complications from that understanding to the clinic, and we can talk about that in a bit. But to answer your question, these collaborations are critical. Our collaboration with UAB is critical. And I know the focus of this podcast is on pediatrics, but we have equally beneficial relationships on the adult side that we believe can take, the paths can correlate, the paths to the clinic, the ultimate path to the patient can benefit from each other. And that's really our development plan. That's our hope. None of this is possible without any of these collaborators.
Now, your efforts to move GB13 to the clinical trial phase not succeeded up to this point. Are these rejections primarily because of financial considerations, or is there something from a medical point of view that's being questioned?
Great question. We would not have the collaborators we do, again, the leading researchers and institutions in DIP, DMG. We would not have them if the science and the drug development or the drug was ever questioned. We're confident that we have the support of both the research and the clinical communities. I probably talked too long. The quickest answer here, it's all financial. This is an economic discussion that, you know, failure is really just hearing a no, and we like the clarity of hearing no, but raising money for what we need to raise money for is the sole rate limiter in our ability to get GB13 to the clinic for pediatric brain cancer.
Now, you're seeking additional partners to help you raise money to help fund a phase one clinical trial. Assuming you get the funding, what is the process from there to receiving approval for the trial? And is the National Institute of Health, or NIH, as most people might refer to, is that the organization that will need to give you this approval?
Let me handle the second part of that. So the FDA would, when we have discussions regarding all of the components of our development, when I say all of the components, this is manufacturing our drug, this is all the animal testing in our drug, this is all the pharmacology and toxicology plans that we have, all of our clinical plans, those are all conducted between us and our clinical collaborators and the FDA. So the NIH would not participate in those discussions, although the NIH, from a funding perspective, is critical to our work. But our discussions in terms of moving GB13 to the clinic is all held with the FDA. In terms of the timing, I mentioned earlier that we are collaborating with a leading consortium of children's hospitals across the world to put together an IND package. An IND package is an investigational new drug package that identifies all of these attributes of our drug and our plans into the clinic. After assembling that package, we really start a two-way dialogue with the FDA. We believe that we're going to have a dialogue with the FDA in the beginning of 2025. We believe that we should be in a position by the end of 2025, if money is in place to do it, to start clinical studies where, and again, I would say, unfortunately, we can quickly, which is to our benefit, we can quickly ascertain the role that GB13 will play in changing the paradigm of care for these patients and their families. Of course, there'll be additional studies based on what we learned from a phase one study. Our clinical collaborators are anticipating what some of those items are, and we try to develop a program that answers those questions in a responsible way so that we can accelerate an approval from the FDA for GB13.
Okay, well, thank you for clarifying that about the FDA versus the NIH. Now, and maybe Randy can answer this question a little bit because he's had obviously experience with prostate cancer and clinical trials. After getting your approval for having a trial like this, how long do you think that it would take for the trial to start? I mean, I'm just talking about, say, a normal process, perhaps, versus GB13 might be a better way of looking at it. And how long after you start the trial does it generally take for enough successes to happen before the medicine actually appears at the bedside of these patients? And how does that compare time-wise with a prostate cancer trial which I would think you would have had many experiences with as far as time and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so it's hard to give really definitive answers on here, but as far as we're thinking about for GB13, once we have the FDA's agreement that what we're trying to do is safe, that's the concern, is that we are doing something that is safe. The trial would be in, you know, could be 90 days, could be started. So that's a pretty quick start. And we have sites that are you know, already, you know, being coordinated to lead these efforts. The convection enhanced delivery does create the need to really have a really focused group of people who are going to be doing the work. Similarly, it's a little different than just giving an oral medication. So that is just kind of something that's already being worked to be in place. You know, one of the big differences, you talk about the difference between prostate and DIPG is that, as Syl said, it unfortunately works to our benefit. The average overall survival of DIPG patients is about 10 months. So you will know fairly soon how effective your therapy is. And because there are not any approved curative therapies for DIPG, the requirements for approval are a little different than for prostate cancer therapy. So for prostate cancer, not everybody's dying from prostate cancer. They might have prostate cancer, but that's not going to be their cause of death. So for that reason, there are a few different hurdles that need to be overcome for approval. And because there's so many other drugs on the market, you have different thresholds that are required for that approval. So the process isn't going to look the same for DIPG as it will for prostate cancer. And each of those have their own hurdles and have their own pros and cons for the drug development. You know, because we're doing a surgical procedure, that is not always the easiest route to go, but we really feel confident that that's the best way to deliver our large molecule for effective therapies. So it's hard to give an exact number, but because there are no options really for these children, the ability to make that a bedside therapy could be a shorter window than for some other cancer types.
Well, certainly 90 days is a lot better than, how long you have to wait often for, you know, perhaps other clinical trials to get started. Again, as you mentioned, the time span is just so short. So it's at least something that in 90 days, as you said, you'll be able to tell after starting, you'll be able to tell pretty quickly if it's working or not. Now, a W.W. Smith charitable grant was awarded to Penn State, the University Department of Neurology, and Targapeutics for GB13. Can you talk about this grant and how important it is as you proceed with your plan of action?
Yeah, this grant was came about because we already had a relationship with an adult neurosurgeon named Alreza Mansouri, who's through the Penn State health system. Already had a lot of nice interactions with him, really familiar with our work. He's really involved in the research community at Penn State. And we just started talking about our similarities and our mutual interest in fighting gliomas. And he's really interested in understanding how novel approaches for biopsies and understanding the targets that are found in gliomas can be used. And we have an equal interest in understanding how our receptor can be identified from patients without needing a biopsy. So we started thinking about some research projects that could be performed, and we realized that we had a really nice overlap of interests and options there. So we're using that grant to understand how we could take blood samples and test the receptor levels and how those receptor levels could change in response to our therapy. So we could use it as a diagnostic and a prognosis indicator, and also understanding how we can maybe modify the expression levels of our target to make it more expressed, or if any impact of therapies can change the way our receptor is expressed as well.
And Mark, if you don't mind, if I can just kind of put some context around this W.W. Smith grant, super important to us, but again, we've been very fortunate with collaborators to be able to get SBIR grants and STTR grants, and we're working on a DOD grant right now with others at the Mayo Clinic, and so when we look at all these grants together and the result of this work, this really necessary funding that allows us to get this data, we really need to put in context with all this other work and all these other results. And again, we have an equally powerful story on the adult GBM side, and are working in collaboration with the leading clinical and research sites around the country on an adult story as well. But again, there's just some context around that. We've been really fortunate with Randy's leadership to be able to get some of these other grants.
Yeah. Now you mentioned UAB, you mentioned the Mayo Clinic, and of course Penn State. Are there any businesses, as opposed perhaps to medical facilities, that you are in partnership with or close to getting in a partnership with which will equally help you in what you're trying to accomplish? And one company that just comes to mind is OncoHeroes Biosciences, which is in the Boston area, and their business is developing drugs.
A really good question. So, let me see if I can organize in my mind a good response. Let's start here. Something I mentioned earlier. We believe that we belong in the paradigm of care in treating DIPG patients. We also believe that, and we've mentioned, the receptor that we target is not found on 100% of these patients. We believe it's found on 75% to 80%. So the majority of them. But what I would say is that we also know that we can reduce tumor burden. We can make radiation more effective. But we also believe that somehow the immune system is going to need to be stimulated and part of this answer. And I would say other companies are working on that part of it. Other companies also have therapies that they're trying to get into this indication. It's our belief that all of those companies need to be in a physician's, a neurosurgeon's toolkit when they're looking at a DIPG DMG patient. So we want to encourage any of these companies to go as hard and as far as they can. I mentioned resources being one of our issues. I think that if we were to partner with another company, so we do look at the interaction of GB13 with other drugs that are used in this area, not really at liberty to discuss the wheres and whys and wherefores of that. But I would say that we don't collaborate with other private or public companies in a way that we would work together. We believe we have a very well-defined, well-understood, and good plan to get to the clinic. And then from there, again, we want to encourage those drug developers that are in the DIPG space to get in that toolkit for that doctor to address this dire need.
That was a very good answer. And you were saying you wanted to organize your mind. You did it nice and quickly.
That's now, unusual for me, Mark.
I doubt that, but in November of 2023, about a year ago, Targapeutics presented your latest data on tumors that were treated with GB13 at the, I believe it's the 28th annual meeting of the Society of Neuro-Oncology. This one was held in the beautiful city of Vancouver, British Columbia. Can you talk about some of the highlights for from your presentation and what the reaction was from the neuro-oncology experts who were there.
Yeah, Beautiful City is right. It's always a privilege to be able to present our work, and it's always nice when it correlates with a great city. We're excited because we're also going to be presenting at this annual conference, which is coming up later this month. Again, it's always in around the same time of November. This time we're going to be presenting it in Houston, Texas. Some additional work that we've been working on. So we are happy and always appreciative of the ability to present our data and to share our data. And we think that sharing our data allows us to advance everybody and not just ourselves. So we are active in the annual meeting. We're active in the pediatric specific meeting that the SNO Society puts on every year, every other year, and in other smaller conferences as well. But you know, Sills referenced this idea about the effect that GB13 can have when combined with radiation, and that's been a really exciting finding for us, and the data that's been generated again with our collaborators has been really impactful. So some of that data includes the animal-based studies and cell-based studies that demonstrate this idea where if we give GB13 first and then add radiation, we see that cells die more, and that radiation has a better effect, and that the combination effect versus just putting them at the same time or putting GB13 after radiation, if we can pre-treat radiation or pre-treat cells and then give radiation, that is the best combination. And we do have some molecular understanding of why that is the case. And we, to kind of say real simply, what the reason GB13 kills cells is that it's stopping the ability of a cell to make new proteins. So if we pre-treat a cell and stop it from being able to make new proteins, then we give radiation. A cell normally wants to try to fix that radiation damage that's caused, but we've already stopped that cell from being able to have those proteins to be made. So we have weakened that cell so that whenever it receives the radiation actually is doing the damage and not being fixed. So that is why we think that this pretreatment with GB13 is more effective than any other combination that's possible. And one of the exciting pieces of data that was done really elegantly was this animal model where our collaborators injected DIPG cells into the pons right on the brainstem of a mouse, which is a microscopic location, and grew a tumor. And then we did this experiment. We did all the different combinations, GB13 alone, radiation alone, or combination. And when we pre-treated GB13 and then gave radiation, those animals did not die from the cancer. Those animals died of old age, which was the first time I've ever been involved in an experiment where that happened. So each of those treatments given by themselves had a little bit of an impact. It helped those animals survive. That combination, those animals never died. When those animals died, they removed the brains. There was no evidence of tumors anymore in those animals. If that doesn't get you excited about the opportunities that are possible in research and being able to translate those into the clinic, then you're never going to have any excitement in your life in this field. Because we were pretty pumped about that, and the response was equally enthusiastic in the community. So, you know, that's what drives us. That's what kind of helps us plan for our clinical procedures and how we think that we can make an impact. It's not with GB13 alone. It's with the combination and filling ourselves into these steps that are already in place in the treatments that are ongoing.
If you achieve the goals that you want to achieve, how much of a game changer do you envision GB13 to be in this DMG and the DIPG fight?
Yeah, I mean, if we could achieve what I just described in that animal setting, I mean, that's a huge game changer. I mean, Sil and I will say this all day, is that Targapeutics is not in it to be a big company making all this money. We're in it to make an impact in the clinic. And that is to have these kids be able to celebrate another birthday, to be able to celebrate multiple birthdays. And that's a game changer. So when I both have kids, I've raised kids, and you know, this is it's personal. I think it's personal for a lot of reasons, but we've talked to enough family families that have been impacted by this disease to know that we have the chance to make an impact. And that's what drives us to continue knocking on doors and asking people to help come along and support us. Because we don't know until we try. We think we have really good evidence for what we can do. And now we won't know it until we actually test it.
Now, when you were talking about prostate cancer before, you used the term chronic disease. DIPG and DMG, unfortunately, are not chronic diseases at this point. Is it realistic to say that maybe in 5 to 10 years, a chronic disease label possibility could be put on these diseases, or is that far, reaching perhaps too far at this point?
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with being hopeful. I don't know what the time frame will look like for that. I mean, there was a time when leukemias were not treatable until we realized what was driving some of those blood cancers. And that's been a game changer also, where we have kids in particular who are now growing into adulthood. So I think it is achievable. I think still mentioned that there are a lot of different therapies that are being pushed ahead right now. And I think if we can all work together, we say it every day, we're not a magic bullet that's going to cure everything ourselves. But we think that if we can get enough treatments available for these patients, that the combinations are going to be possible to make this a chronic disease. We don't think that this is going to happen overnight. We think that a lot of people are going to have to work together and come sit around the same table. So that's what Syl's great at, getting people organized towards a common goal. But I think 5 or 10 years, I think 10 years, I love that. I mean, it would be amazing. And I think that it's where we're pushing to help you.
Yeah, Mark, I would add on top of that, this is like everything in life. One sure way of it not happening is not trying. And so in this community, we really need to understand what are those impediments for people not to try. And we've talked about some of the things that have happened over in this research community that have made a huge impact on the ability for successes to happen. We need to continue to break down whatever those barriers are for people to try.
Here's a question I'd like to ask both of you. In our discussion, we've gone over a lot of information. Is there anything that either one of you can say that I have neglected to bring up in this conversation that is something that either one of you want to mention as you continue to work on what you're doing? For example, is there anything, say, after GB13 in the next number of years that you would be looking at? I guess that would be one question I would want to ask that I have not.
You mean in addition to, like, something outside of GB13?
Correct.
Yeah. So one of those things that we're actively pursuing right now is just understanding how to discern what the patient population is. So it's still, it's not necessarily related to GB13, but it's understanding a population of patients that would be responsive to targeted therapies or any therapy that's targeted to the IL-13 receptor alpha 2. So one of our collaborations we have ongoing is to understand how we can have a biomarker developed to non-invasively detect tumor cells that express our target. We're not the only player in this field. There are other approaches that are being taken to target our receptor of interest. In particular, CAR T therapy is already being used in adult settings with this target. So we think we can have a benefit, not just for our own program, but other programs that are involved in this area as well. We're pretty excited about that coming into the pipeline.
I would like to ask one more question that just came up. I did a podcast the other day on DIPG, and the young boy, I think he lasted couple of years, and he was treated at St. Jude. And one of the things they did was they did a clinical trial, some sort of a trial with chemotherapy, which of course radiation and is the one thing that you generally use, as you obviously well know, in DIPG. Had you heard of chemotherapy being used as a clinical trial in DIPG? And is that something that is coming, or was it perhaps just a one-shot deal, or not just a one-shot deal, but a limited trial from St. Jude, do you think?
Yeah, I'd have to go back and probably, I mean, that trial would obviously be reported on clinicaltrials.gov, which is where we go to a lot of times to kind of be kept up on the clinical trials that are in the works. You know, I think that there is enough evidence of clinical of chemotherapy being used in adult indications for glioma treatment to possibly warrant that exploration and to kind of investigate if that is a way. And there are certain mutations that predispose sensitivity to chemotherapy, such as temozolomide, and it's possible that he might have had a rare mutation that suggests that he would be responsive to that. So it's not a common approach, but I think it is something that is being considered because of its utility in adult treatments.
Thank you for making that clear to me. Where can people get in touch with you? And I know it's going to be on the website. So whoever wants to give me the information, that'd be great.
Well, I mean, Mark, again, we really love talking to anybody and everybody about this disease and about our development and our plans. If anybody wants to reach out to us, we welcome the discussion. And it is the website. It's targetpeutics.com, targetpeutics.com. Both of our emails are on there. There's a telephone number on there. Frankly, it's my cell number. I love being involved in Targetpeutics and in the development of GB13 and with our collaborators and with our and in this patient population. I will talk to anybody and everybody at any time of the day, you know, that's weekends, nights, you know, that's practical, and would really welcome any interaction.
Well, as we come to the end of this podcast, first of all, I want to thank Syl. I was fortunate enough to sit two or three seats away from you at the DIPG breakfast at CureFest, and you were nice enough to involve Randy into this conversation, and thank you to both for taking the time to come on my podcast and give such riveting information and important information. And as you said, Randy, you know, this is an exciting time for you as you approach something that's, you know, that has never happened. And you're, as you said, you're playing a part in this. And if the collaboration, which, you know, you both have talked about, can it's already been coming together. It continues that way. And you're, you know, instrumental in putting this such a, the worst possible form of pediatric cancer and pediatric brain cancer into a much better situation. I mean, there really can't be much better than anything better than that. And I want to wish to thank you again for taking the time, you know, to do such a great job in explaining what you're trying to do and what you have done. And hopefully the future for DIPG will be improved as soon as possible. And again, thanks for taking the time. You did it. It was terrific having both of you. And Randy, it was nice to meet you as well as meeting Syl a few weeks ago.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. We have the highest hopes that this disease will be address, that we will be part of it. And again, grateful, Mark, to you and your platform here for allowing us to tell our story.
That was certainly my pleasure, and enjoy the rest of your day.
You as well. Take care.
Thanks.
I hope that you appreciated hearing Syl and Randy talk about in great detail what they have been doing to help these kids and their families be able to use the word hope in the future when talking about DIPG and DMG. We all hope that Targapeutics will be able to finally get the financing that they need so that GB13 is approved for a clinical trial as soon as possible. This is Mark Levine, and please tune in on Monday when I will speak with Elan Klein, who will talk about her son Noah, who was yet another victim of DIPG.